Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your co-hosts are Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor, and Pastor Charles Roberts.
When we began this podcast back in early 2018, the motivation was that too often Christians don't ask the right questions in dealing with issues as we as a culture face. Rather than think through an issue biblically, often they fail to identify the real threat and respond reactively to surface issues. Since the beginning of the new administration, many are relieved that much of the debauchery of the last administration is being reversed. They are also finding satisfaction in discovering the magnitude of the waste and fraud in the federal government. However, there are some moves by the administration that are distressing to many. One is the appointing of Paula White in the reestablishment of the White House Office of Faith, or the White House Faith Office. Surprisingly, many are upset that the president appointed a woman to the post. But have they asked the question that should be asked? Should the federal government have an office of faith, and what influence, if any, should it wield? Charles, since you suggested this topic, let's start with your ideas.
Well, I think to your point there about people were scandalized, some people were, that he would appoint a woman to this office, and not simply a woman, but that woman. Paula White has, I think, to put it generously, a checkered history in terms of theological orientation and personal life and all that sort of thing. And it's easy to get sidetracked by that. And I think the bigger question is, and you just hinted at it, is should anybody be occupying this office? And I've thought about this as we have launched into it and as I suggested it, because this was hard news on the evangelical news front for about a week or two recently. What if this was a slightly different time and President Trump had appointed the late Dr. Gary North to this position, or Greg Bonson, or R.J. Rushdoony, or R.C. Sproul, whatever, you know, name you want to mention, assuming that any of those people were alive and would have even considered accepting such an appointment? But, you know, would that make a difference? I suppose in some people's minds it would. But again, it skirts the larger issue as to whether or not government has any business at all with something like this. And the fact that our states that make up these United States, even when we established a federal constitution and a so-called federal government, even prior to Abraham Lincoln, there was never any need or the idea that any such office would be created. So the very fact that it was done, and it doesn't matter who did it, in terms of establishing it or reestablishing it, I know it. I'm looking at the executive order on the whitehouse.gov website that establishes this office dated February 7th, 2025. And it's referencing other administrations with similar types of departments, I'll put it that way.
Right.
So it raises, I think, for anybody who understands the dangers of statism and the unending combat between humanism and biblical faith, and the fact that humanism has its ultimate expression in the state. And it doesn't matter who the president is, what the party is who's in charge, so-called. It is nevertheless a fact that the state constantly tries to assume the authority that God gives to the family and the church.
Exactly. And it was funny because I was also casually seeing certain things, whether it was on social media or emails that came. The emails, I might say, that no matter how many times you unsubscribe, you seem to get 20 more in their place. So I was seeing this about Paula White. And as you said, she's got an interesting past, and I put interesting in quotes. And what I was wondering was, okay, who would they have wanted to see in this role? Not too many people were complaining about the fact that the audacity of saying that the federal government is going to have an office. You know, we deal with agriculture and we deal with faith. And then, of course, faith can have a wide range of implications that, you know, there are many roads that lead to God, et cetera, et cetera. But there were very few that were even talking jurisdictionally. And when I talked about superficial reactions, it's as though people's attention spans are so short that all they can remember is what they didn't like about the last guy, and the new guy is going to change everything. And not only does it show a lack of faith in God, but it shows a real ignorance of the Constitution, which everybody likes to throw around. This is unconstitutional. This is constitutional. I doubt many people have even read it ever, and I wonder how many have read it recently.
Are you referring to the U.S. Constitution?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, those, of course, are very good questions. And I think many of us, maybe we read it at some point when we were in school, in elementary or junior high or high school. Probably not since then. I know a couple of conservative talk show hosts, one in particular I'm thinking of, who would send out and hand out free copies of a pocket constitution. And certainly that's an important thing. But as R.J. Rushdoony famously said, the Constitution cannot save this country. And this is one of the things that's, to use a modern phrase, concerning about this White House Office of Faith. And I would encourage our listeners, I realize this won't come out for another week or so, but even then, go to the whitehouse.gov website or just do a search for White House Office of Faith, and it'll take you to the link where you can read the establishment of the office and the executive order that created it. And it's divided up into sections: the policy, amendments to the executive orders, White House Faith Office functions. And what's interesting about this is that, and I'll just give our listeners a very quick sample. This is from Section 1, Policy. Faith-based entities, community organizations, and houses of worship have tremendous ability to serve individuals, families, and communities through means that are different from those of government and with capacity and effectiveness that often exceeds that of government. And he goes on to there to talk about how important these institutions are and these faith-based entities. But now listen to this. The executive branch wants faith-based entities, community organizations, and houses of worship to the fullest extent permitted by law to compete on the level playing field for grants, contracts, programs, and other federal funding opportunities. So I'm just going to end it there. It goes on. So what's significant, I think, about this is that nowhere in any of this policy or this order is anything stipulated about what defines a faith-based entity. Now, of course, our nation was founded as a Christian nation. That's a disputable concept today, I guess, but it's indisputable if you look at the early history. And the original 13 colonies were all Christian to a greater or lesser extent. And some of them, even as we've talked before in this podcast, having religious oaths that were required before you could either run for office or even cast a vote in a civil election. So a Muslim, a Jew, a Buddhist, a Hindu might move into pre-colonial South Carolina or Maryland or New York, and they would get along just fine as long as they weren't trying to do something against biblical law. Now, of course, that's all gone. And so, as I said, there's no mention whatever about which religions, which churches, which faith-based organizations are being supported by this.
Right. And the whole part about that they'll be eligible for grants. So maybe, I haven't quite frankly been up on this, if Christian organizations or Jewish organizations have been denied federal money. But for goodness sakes, if we're going to say there should be a separation between church and state in terms of their functions and jurisdiction, is it just that everybody should be happy now that the Christian hand or the Jewish hand or whatever can be, you know, held out so that they get a piece of the pie? If you think back on Rome, Rome actually had no problem with religion. It actually liked people having religious commitments because they thought it kept them in line and kept them happy. It's when that one particular religion, the religion of Christianity, said, no, Caesar isn't Lord, Jesus is Lord, that now there was a problem. So could it be that this office of faith or this faith office is designed to make sure we just keep all these religions in line?
I think that's definitely a part of it. And whether or not the people back of it would articulate it that way, that doesn't change the reality. I'm glad you mentioned Rome, because this is the most comparable example that we have and that you had an all-powerful state. You had sovereign power vested in early Rome in the Senate and the people, and then in later Rome in the emperor, along with those two to a lesser extent. But either way, there was no mistaking where the authority was. And the gods of the Roman pantheon were just simply an extension of the state. And as Russ Dooney tirelessly never ceased to point out, is that where humanism dominates, it eventuates into an all-powerful state because the state is the highest expression of human aspiration. And we have the example of that in the book of Genesis of the building of the Tower of Babel. This was a movement toward federalizing and centralizing human authority without regard to the law of God.
One of the things that I think is interesting, because to be very honest with you, Charles, I didn't know who Paula White was. I don't keep up on such things. And when you do some research on her, she, first of all, has ideas in terms of sexuality, even within marriage, that most people would consider wrong from God's law word. But, this isn't a new thing. She's been a friend, confidant, advisor, supporter of Donald Trump way back to the first presidency.
Yes.
And, it's so funny to me how when you get someone who's better than someone else, okay, so I think most people who are listening to this will say, yeah, it's better that there's a President Trump than there's a President Harris, okay? But that you don't have to make everything that this president does good. As a matter of fact, it's important if you're going to be honest before God and before everyone else to call people out. They might be right on A through F, but then the rest of the alphabet a little wonky. But when there were so many people who were coming down on the fact that he picked a woman. Now, as a woman, let me state that the Bible is particular on certain things a woman cannot do. Just like biologically, there are certain things a man cannot do. So I am not one advocating for, an androgynous society where everybody does what everybody else does. God has put boundaries. But this whole idea that it would be wrong for a woman to be anybody's advisor. Well, in marriage, pity the man who doesn't use his wife as an advisor. Jesus had a lot of supporters and disciples, but he commends and calls out women, specific women, in terms of what they did to further his work, to further the kingdom. So when this then deteriorates into a man-woman thing, and he should never have picked a woman, and what how terrible that all is, all it does is, I think, play into the conflict of interest that loves to prevail, even in the church, the patriarchy, the feminism, or whatever it is. We know that the president's wife, we wouldn't categorize her as a good spiritual advisor to her husband because we know that she doesn't have a problem with women ending the life of unborn children. So the fact that he might have another advisor isn't so bad. It's just that when you take a look at the man himself, he kind of surrounds himself in this arena with people who will not be too far off from his beliefs. Now, that's not to say that everybody in his administration compromises their faith. What I'm saying is, if we don't look at it from a biblical point of view and really examine it, the axe may not be getting to the root of the problem and we're snipping branches.
Yeah, let's go back to ancient Rome for a bit, shall we? And I want to tiptoe around this as delicately as I can because I don't like to recommend movies because I'm not sure what people would be willing to watch or not watch. But I'll just put it this way. In the past several years, there have been one or two movies with the theme of being connected to gladiatorial games and ancient Rome. And in one of those movies in particular, you get a sense of how politics work then and how they work now. Because in this one particular movie, this one gladiator was looked upon by key members of the Roman Senate as someone who could serve their political ends of wanting to gain a certain amount of advantage over the then ruling emperor. And so all these sort of backroom deals are going on. People are talking about how they can use this guy to their advantage and how they can take care of this. And unfortunately, Christians, if they don't think that sort of thing goes on in this day and time, even among their so-called favorite politicians or favorite political party, they're sadly mistaken. Now, the fact is, I remember seeing this, I can't remember where I saw these statistics or this discussion, but it was an article, and this was prior to the past election that re-elected President Trump. It was a discussion about the influence and the value of the evangelical Christian voting bloc. And now, within that broad term evangelical, we would be including, everybody who was conservative, quote unquote, theologically and politically, who was not a Roman Catholic or Greek Orthodox. So that's a wide group of people. And this particular discussion pointed out that I think, if I'm not mistaken, that that was the single largest voting bloc of any group of people, no matter how you define it, ethnically, religiously, however it might be. So politicians, especially those who might appeal to that more conservative element, have a special interest in making sure that those people vote for them or are favorable toward their plans and purposes. Although you and I and others of like mind make up are part of that broad group according to their classifications. Our way of thinking, I'll just say broadly Reformed, Reconstructionist, Calvinistic, Theonomic, whatever term you want to put to it, is very small compared to the larger Baptist, Bible, Church, Charismatic, Pentecostal churches. So I don't think that the appointment of this woman in particular was just haphazard, as well, either this time around or in the previous administration of President Trump. There's a famous picture, and I think there's actually a video, when he was first elected in 2016 and 2017, of a group of pastors. I don't know if this was in the Oval Office. I'm not sure where it was. I don't think it was in the Oval Office, but they were praying on over him, laying hands on him. And right in the middle of them was Paula White. But there were a lot of others, and some of these were very recognizable, popular, charismatic, as in Pentecostal TV preachers and leaders. And I'm mentioning all this because I think there's a certain amount of cynicism on the part of politicians that they don't care one thing or the other about what these people teach or believe. They just see the influence and the vast audience that they have. So I think that people ought to realize that even if it's somebody other than a Paula White, substitute your favorite teacher or preacher. We're back to the very central question. What in the world does government have any business establishing a house or a department of faith and offering money and grants? I would ask our listeners also to ponder. Well, I'll just ask you, Andrea. I know you reasonably well. What if I took a plane out to California and I showed up on your doorstep and I said, the Lord spoke to me and he told me to give you this suitcase and it had $20,000 in cash in it. I mean, how would you react to that? You might be overjoyed, but then there's always got to be that little question. If I take this money, what kind of indebtedness am I going to have? I know, he said I didn't have to pay it back. But
Right.
there's always that question. You're going to be connected somehow if you accept a gift like that.
Well, I think the expression is he who pays the piper calls the tune.
Yes, good one. Yeah.
So I think that what's important here to remember, keeping in mind what you said about wanting a certain voting bloc, but not necessarily caring what the people think or do. They just, they care what they do. They want them to vote for their guy and such, is to realize that any selection would have angered someone. And that's what really is the question, is should there even be such a thing? Well, people say, yes, well, the First Amendment guarantees whatever. Okay, the First Amendment says it. Remember, the amendments to the Constitution were not because they thought some preacher somewhere was going to try to take over the world. It was so that the federal government would keep their hands out of areas that they had no jurisdiction in. So the First Amendment is a jurisdictional amendment that says you can't go here. When it comes to how people worship, the federal government makes no rules. And so when the pendulum swings, when we have one president that does 75 executive orders that we don't like, and then the new person comes in and then he changes it all. Do we really think that the answer is going to be politics? Because regardless of how much you might like a guy in office, he won't be there forever. And it presupposes that the answer to problems are political answers. as opposed to people repenting. I'd be all for a White House Office of Faith and a website that says, repent, the kingdom of God is at hand. That's all you'd really have to put on that website because it would acknowledge the fact that the answer or the solutions aren't going to come politically.
Yes, and I come back to this significant point that when the Constitution was formed, there was mainly a biblical understanding. I realize not all the founding fathers were what we would call Bible-believing Christians, but they operated largely from that worldview, even if they individually weren't. But many of them, I would even say maybe most were, in terms of their views of morality, and especially the position of the state and the responsibility of individuals to govern themselves according to biblical morality. And what many people may not realize is that there is a deep theological connection between thinking of government and individual responsibility and what a society will look like, and a contrary view of a theological perspective that leads to a totalitarian or statist-centered understanding. And what starts to happen is especially if you start with the biblical pattern, over time, if people aren't careful, it begins to erode. And I've mentioned in previous podcasts, I've been preaching through the book of Daniel. And one of the things that God revealed to Daniel was that in the future ahead of him and the Old Covenant Church, the Israelites, would be the destruction of their society or the attempted destruction of it by a significant leader. Now, history knows this man to be Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He attacked Jerusalem. He slaughtered thousands of people. He desecrated the temple by sacrificing a pig on the altar and erecting a statue of the Greek god Zeus in the Holy of Holies. What's significant about that is that he was able to do that because he gained a foothold within the inhabitants, especially the leaders, some of the Jewish leaders, that he made deals with them. And that gave him a foothold to come in. And what we see there is that in the areas of morality, doctrine, and governmental understanding, these are the areas that can be compromised so easily by satanic attack. And once that happens, then we're open to false ideas about the position of the state and where are we have freedom of religion, or we believe in the separation of church and state. You can say all that all you want, but over time, those things get redefined, and you don't think there's a problem when there really is one.
Or people don't understand when their religious freedom is being infringed upon. For example, closing churches during COVID because they would be super spreader events. So a lot of churches said, okay, we're going to be good citizens. But citizens of where? Their state, the United States, or the kingdom of God? That you weren't allowed to sing or you must wear a mask. See, these are things that violate the whole idea of individual conscience. And I dare say that a lot of the splits that have happened among family, among friends, even among churches, has to do with who is the voice of authority. And that when somebody dares say, no, I don't agree, this is not right, we are going to meet because we're told we should meet together. That somebody tells them that, you're just a fanatic and you don't really care about other people, et cetera. I'm not sure that the problem really just manifested itself during COVID, that it was already there. People didn't understand what their presuppositions were, what their hopes were for, and who they actually put their trust in.
Absolutely, it was already there. And we can go back, I guess, at least to the early 20th century and see these tendencies. I think most people that I'm familiar with who have done research and writing on this really date it back to the 19th century and the war between the states, because what we know today as the federal government really was born out of that conflict. And the federal authority took on aspects that did not exist prior to that conflict. And this is a thing that is very important for people to understand, is that crises are used by cynical politicians and people who want power in government, or we could even say the church for that matter, I guess, to bring things about that under ordinary circumstances, people would not be the least bit interested or prone to do. And so whenever a crisis, real or imagined, is there, and you just mentioned one, a disease or a sickness, It could be a supposed enemy across the ocean. People are willing to give up their freedom at the drop of a hat. Most of us of a certain age can remember when you could actually go with your friend to the airport and go right to the gate and see them off on their flight without going through all the security and all. And of course, if you can't even do that. Even you can't get through security unless you have certain ticket in your hand, all that kind of thing. That's just one simple way that our society has been completely changed because of fear, because of the supposed protection. Our ancestors, especially in these United States, dealt with all kinds of threats, but they didn't see the need to shut down individual liberty and squash discussion. And I want to mention one thing in particular, if I may. In this White House directive creating this Department of Faith, I think it's very troubling myself. It's not the first time this has been suggested or brought up, but it talks about the government calling on experts and leaders based on their expertise and to talk about things lifting up individuals, also defending, I'm reading now, defending religious liberty. Now, note this, combating anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, and additional forms of anti-religious bias. Now, I mentioned this in particular because, who's going to decide what is anti-religious bias? And I know in the case of the first thing mentioned, anti-Semitic, there have been several notable cases where people were criticizing the modern state of Israel from a social and political standpoint, without any saying anything about Jews in particular or their religion, and they were branded anti-Semitic. So already we've crossed into an area here where this is very troubling and very, very problematic.
So going back to the founding of the United States, the Constitutional Convention, I've been reading recently some of what was taking place during that convention. Interestingly enough, had there been television cameras at the time, they wouldn't have been allowed in. They didn't allow any reporters in. And a lot of what took place in that convention later came out when people's diaries were or journals were published. But they knew that they had to put something together because they didn't like what they had. And I don't think there was any illusion because there was enough conflict. And there were times during the convention where people like Washington and Franklin and Madison, they were pretty sure this was never even going to happen. And so God in his providence had the U.S. Constitution formulated. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that there's lots of compromise built into that document.
Yes.
And there's a tendency to look at the document as if it is not quite on the same level as inspired scripture, but close. So once you know all the debates, the fact that there were people who, for example, were very much against slavery, let's deal with it now. And then there were people who were like, no, if we really push this point, it'll never happen. And so people who were very anti-slavery knew that they could die on that hill and then not have a federal government or have a United States. And there were many who thought, well, we're just setting the stage for what happened in 1860. So the first thing we have to realize is that the document in and of itself is not infallible. And they knew it wasn't going to be infallible because they had provisions for amending it if need be. But what they did have in common, whether they were quote unquote Unitarians or deists or Trinitarians or whatever they were, and this is another book I've just finished reading, there were four qualities that America at the time embraced. Industry, honesty, morality, and religiosity. And they knew that those four things were going to make it so that this Constitution could possibly work. And as you said, what the broad stroke of religiosity was, the Bible. Now, different people had different interpretations. Certainly, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson didn't look at the Bible the way you or I might. But there still was this basis of this commonality. And morality meant marriage. Morality meant that what you would do is get married and have children, and then the country would flourish. Well, we don't have those four tenets in place today. I doubt sincerely if you look at the average state school graduate that industry, honesty, morality, and religiosity are the foremost tenets of how that person's going to live his or her life. So when we look at this office being created, it needs to be viewed in terms of how much has already been lost and the opportunity those of us who understand God's definite and distinct jurisdictions, that like many other things, we're now in a position to talk about it in terms of what the Bible actually says, as opposed to making it that he appointed a woman or something like that.
Yeah, you've mentioned this several times about the fact that some people were very concerned that he appointed a woman to this position. I must have missed some of that because either because of my own knowledge of Paula White's background, I wasn't that was not the first thing I was struck by. Obviously, it was, I guess, for some others. And like you said, you said you'd never heard of her before. Well, I certainly had, and she has a long history. She and her former husband pastored a big church in Florida for a while. I think that's where I first heard about her. Anyway, she's had several different recreations of herself and her ministry and marriages and things like that. But the fact that this was done at all, like I said before, substitute the name, I thought was the most significant thing. And so I just wonder, take an issue like you mentioned, morality and marriage. Well, we know that the federal government has been involved in defining marriage and defining family in a way that is contrary to biblical faith. And I don't know of anyone in the current administration, anyone of public note, major office holder in the public and the current administration. I don't mean, Congress or the Senate, I mean in the White House and the cabinet, who would, if they do harbor the idea of marriage can only be legitimately between a man and a woman, biological man, biological woman, throw on all these, adjectives nowadays. They certainly haven't said so. And I'm guessing that probably anyone would be okay with same-sex marriage in the current administration. I think the president himself has been in favor of that. So if someone has on biblical grounds an objection to that, and it somehow spills over into governmental or legal issues, and sometimes it has. And what can they appeal to this office and say, I need your help? When you've got such a broad stroke about what is faith-based, how are you going to come down anywhere that is not going to be contrary to a particular group? My guess is what would happen is that considerations would be taken. Somebody would lick their finger and put it up in the air to see which way the wind is blowing, and that would determine the result of the decision to help this person in that particular issue.
Think about it. We live in a time where even those who call themselves Bible-believing Christians, and all you have to do to know that there's a wide swath, because you go to most churches' website and they'll tell you what their beliefs are, and then you see some of the practices and you're going, well, I don't see how these two things go together, because we have elevated interpretation to the point where, well, that's not how I read it. I read it this way. And somebody goes, well, okay, that's not how I read it. Well, man does not live by bread alone, but by every interpretation he has of God's word. That's not what the quote is. It's by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. But we've made things so relative that, everybody remembers it during the Clinton impeachment. It depends on what the definition of is. So, as soon as we lose the idea that there are absolute standards, then it becomes very easy for anybody in power to now make sweeping judgments. So, we talked about this Office of Faith. Well, there was another executive order that talked about making in vitro fertilization readily accessible. Well, if we ever were going to talk about a religious issue, there it is. And some people think it's fine and other people don't. And a huge clientele for in vitro fertilization are same-sex couples who need somebody else, a male, or if they're just two males, they need a female. If they're two females, they need a male in order to produce offspring. So, on top of the fact that he's decided that this has to be something that the government backs, why? Well, I think you and I can guess maybe why. But why aren't people saying this has no place coming from the president of the United States that now we're going to have policies that say these things are now have to be made easier and more affordable? unless you look at it and say, what are people doing and why, you're always going to be going with the tide, except sometimes you're not going to like the water coming at you, and other times you're going to be happier with it.
You know, I sometimes think that if we lived in a different time, that, I mean, this is kind of a weird comparison, but I'll just put it this way. I think that there are some people who, if Adolf Hitler donned a Boston Red Sox jersey, would think he was probably a pretty good guy. There's some people who would think that if Joseph Stalin put on a Dallas Cowboys jersey and rooted for the Cowboys, he's a pretty good guy. You see, the point I'm trying to make is that people, especially in conservative Christian circles, they focus on particular big-ticket issues, and as long as the guy's pressing those buttons, I don't have to worry about the rest of it. And the in vitro fertilization example is an excellent one. And I can think of a couple of different supposedly conservative radio and TV personalities who also happen to be homosexuals and in, quote, homosexual marriages, who have taken advantage of that option of having in vitro fertilization so they can birth their own child, quote unquote. And it creates an interesting cognitive dissonance, I think, that people who follow some of these conservative TV networks and radio networks that platform these people, what do they do with that? Are you concerned that you might agree that this guy, he's pro this, he's pro that, but he's supposedly married to another man and they paid for somebody to have a baby for them, and then the baby was pretty much purchased, in other words, right, and enslaved by these.
It becomes a very interesting thing. So if you're going to be saved by politics, you will also be persecuted by politics. Just like either you're going to bow the knee to Christ and you'll be saved, or you'll be judged. And it's so easy to switch this out. And what is due to the triune God is often given to status government. And it's time people really looked at it, because you might end up on the wrong side of it, never having thought, well, wait a minute, I thought these people were on my side.
Yeah, and before I forget, before we come to the end of our broadcast here, I want to recommend one of Dr. Rushdoony's books, Christianity and the State. I think it's been, my copy is an older hardback copy. I don't know if Chalcedon has republished it in a paperback form. I think they have, a more recent edition. Just about every chapter in this book is vital reading along the lines of what we're talking about today, or even if we weren't talking about it. Everybody should read this book. And I think the one of the chapters is a fascinating one called The Atheism of the Early Church, and atheism with in quotes. And that was published as a separate, very small, slim paperback volume. That too would be well worth getting hold of. Because long before a lot of people were talking about these kind of things, Dr. Rushdoony's voice was the lone one out there saying, you better look out what's going on here. And there are deep theological connections here relating to our view of Christ and the incarnation. Christology is the big term, and the state. And if we aren't careful, even though we've voted for the right person or the right party is in office, regardless of who that may be, we're going to wind up with a totalitarianism that none of us can be happy with.
And for those people who might not be able to say, okay, I already have a stack of books, a number of years ago, we did a series of recordings called the Book of the Month Club, and we would tackle different titles of R.J. Rushdoony, and just a bunch of people would show up and we'd have a discussion. And I do believe that Christianity and the State was one of those books. So you could listen to that discussion and get a sense of, okay, this is what the book is about, and maybe make that your introduction to it. But I agree with you, Charles. We're rarely aware of the tentacles of how statism has entered into our lives, to the point that we're excited when the state gives us permission to do something God has told us to do.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, folks, I hope we've either introduced you to something you didn't even know was a thing, or helped you look at it from a different point of view. As always, we love feedback. So that feedback can be directed via email to outofthequestionpodcast@gmail.com. Charles, I look forward to talking with you next time.
Thanks, Andrea.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit calcedon.edu.